It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Christina Warren's here from Mashable. Ed Botts here from ZDNet. We're going to talk about Windows 10. Why not 9? What's new in Windows 10? Apple Pay, why Bill Gates thinks it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and a farewell to Steve Jobs. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit This Week in Tech, episode 478, recorded October 5th, 2014. I'm an insider. This Week in Tech is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter makes hiring faster, easier, and cheaper. Post your job to 50-plus job boards with one click. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. That's ZipRecruiter.com/twit. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free 2-week trial and 10% off, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code TWIT. And by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get 2 free books. Go to audible.com/twit2. And don't forget to follow Audible on Twitter. User ID audible_com. And by Citrix GoToMeeting, the proven solution for meeting and collaborating online. If you sign up for GoToMeeting before October 10th, you'll get another Citrix product free for 6 months. Visit GoToMeeting.com to get started. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show that talks about the week's tech news. Thanks first to Mike Elgin for filling in for me last week. No, I was here last week. I just don't remember it. Mike did not fill in for me. I was actually here. You mean I've been to London and back since the last show? Is that what happened? Unbelievable. Joining us now, Christina Warren from Mashable. Good to have you, Christina.
Glad to be here.
From her evil lair in New York, New York.
It is evil, yes. And it is a lair.
Yes. And from his evil lair in Santa Fe, New Mexico, Mr. Ed Bott of ZDNet fame. Hi, Ed.
And hi, Christina.
Did you come up, Ed, for the briefing, the Microsoft briefing this week?
I did.
The one-hour briefing?
Flew up one afternoon and flew back the next afternoon.
Paul Theriot just spent the whole day bitching about the fact that he had to fly out for a one-hour briefing. Was it worth it?
Yes.
It's a big story, right? It's a huge story.
Yeah, it was a big story. It was bigger than I think any of us thought it was going to be.
Well, tell me about that. What did you expect, and what was it that you didn't expect?
I think I expected Windows 8 Update 2. And there's clearly more to it than that. And the choice of the name Windows 10 was startling, to say the least. And they clearly have some ideas more than this is more than just transplanting a start menu onto Windows 8. There's some interesting stuff happening there.
So yeah, because I mean. I think a lot of us before the event thought that Windows, well, Threshold, which is the code name at the time, would be to Windows 8 what Windows 7 was to Vista, a polishing of the edges, fixing of some of the cosmetic stuff. Is there stuff under the hood that's significantly different?
Well, we haven't seen it yet, if it is.
Well, you're using it right now, aren't you?
Yes, but this is... a technical preview, and in historical terms, this one is missing. This reminds me a lot of Windows 8 when it first appeared and didn't have, there were several key features that appeared in it later that didn't exist in Windows 8, including, I think, some key aspects of the start screen and Metro apps and so forth weren't there. So I think we're going to see another build of this probably in January that'll have a lot more stuff in it, including some of the stuff that was bizarre to me about this week's event was they positioned it as an enterprise preview.
Right.
And yet most of the discussion is about the things that are fairly superficial on the desktop. And the new features that are going to be in the Enterprise Edition aren't going to appear until later.
So we're only seeing the beginnings of this. One thing that surprised me was they said that the release of this is a year out.
Middle of next year.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's probably 9 months, which means 3 months from now for a consumer-ready beta, 3 months after that for a release candidate, 3 months after that for a release to manufacturing or release to the web, whatever they want to call it these days. So I think you're probably 6 months away from having a feature complete product and 9 months away from having a commercially finished product.
So this is really pretty early in the cycle for
still. Yeah, it's early in a compressed and fast moving cycle also.
Well, that's the other thing. Yeah, there seems to be some hustle to get a replacement for Windows 8 out as quickly as possible.
Well, next year will be 3 years,
which is right. That's the normal time frame.
It's the normal time frame. So it's not really a hustle. They've just been...
It just feels like a hustle. It's like we just got Windows 8.
Well, it'll be 3 years, except it'll be 6 years from Windows 7. And they're still trying to, you know, they had good enterprise upgrade uptick on that, but they didn't really have that on Windows 8, which they said a number of times during the event. So, I mean, I think that's, to me, the big takeaway was that it's an enterprise focus, right? But it's enterprise focus in the sense that they want to talk to the stakeholders and the people making purchasing decisions now before they set their budgets for next year so that they can go ahead and budget to upgrade to, you know, Windows 10 and not lose another, you know, upgrade cycle for these businesses to, or even worse, you know, lose them going to, you know, Chromebooks or God forbid Macs or, you know, virtual machines or something like that. They want to keep them in the Windows ecosystem. And it's important for them to talk to them as early as possible because Windows 8 was such a huge failure on the enterprise front.
Well, and that's the first thing that leaps to mind for me is are desktop operating systems important going forward? They seem like they're less and less important, and who knows by next year how important they'll be. Ed, do you feel like clearly Microsoft made its bones with Windows and to a lesser degree Office, but it also seems like the future is operating system independent. It's cloud. And it seems like Nadella is very aware of that. He's very cross-platform. How important is Windows 10 to Microsoft going forward, I guess, is the question.
You know, it's a key part of their DNA.
Still their flagship.
They can't afford to screw it up. Mm-hmm. And they have basically good architectural underpinnings for it in Windows 8. They just have a bunch of deployment blockers that they need to remove there. The desktop PC market space isn't getting smaller. It's the number of screens that we have on which we can interact with our world is getting so much bigger that as a proportion, desktop PCs are less important because there's so many other ways that we interact with
things.
That's
a great point. There aren't fewer PCs out there. We just have many other ways of computing.
Right. And so that's so things like Office 365, for example, which will be released on Android, I think, this year. It already exists on iOS devices. It exists on Windows devices. And so you can, with a phone, a phablet, a tablet, or a PC, you can do work.
Yeah. And you'll be working likely on the same document in the cloud on each platform.
Exactly. And it might be in a private cloud on an Office 365 enterprise server that's managed by an enterprise, or it might be in a publicly available free cloud like OneDrive, which is, you know, more of a consumer service. But in either case, you're going to be interacting with that on whatever screen you want, running whatever OS you want. I think Microsoft has pretty much realized that it needs to make sure that that experience is good, solid, capable, productive, regardless of what the operating system is and what the screen size is.
And I would guess that security is another you already mentioned the blockers from the point of view of the enterprise, which are mostly right. user interface issues, right? Things like the start menu.
Right.
And you know, most of the coverage is, okay, they got a start menu with tiles. So it's a little bit of both, but it's still a start menu. They've got menued Metro apps now, no longer full screen. Windowed, I shouldn't say, not menued. They're no
windowed.
Longer, yeah.
They can be full screen. There's the option for full screen.
That's just how it should be.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's appropriate for full screen, especially in a tablet environment. Sometimes not. Give me the choice.
Yeah. So, you know, to sort of close the loop on a question, a really good question that you asked just a couple minutes ago, I think the real challenge for Microsoft next year is going to be to establish that it can deliver mobile devices.
Wait a minute. What the hell was that? I'm sorry. If you're watching at home, Chad just decided that we would. Did we get it?
Go!
Oh, we got 3 points. That's
there
good.
We go.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Not what I meant.
That was an error.
I just thought I had said something really smart.
Go! That's only for you watching home. For the audio listeners, nothing to see here. Move on.
Sorry about that.
So, but it is an issue, as desktop operating systems are not. Clearly, it's important to Microsoft. They can't abandon Windows. Right. But they also have to acknowledge the fact that the world has changed quite a bit since, 1995.
Right. So you have tablets and you have these two-in-one devices, which Intel and Microsoft and a lot of the OEMs, Lenovo in particular, have been very successful with getting these two-in-one devices.
Have they been successful? The convertibles, they've been successful?
They have been. I think the latest numbers that I saw said in the retail channel, something like, I should probably look it up, but I think it was about 1 in 4 PCs sold in 2014 are going to be convertibles.
Interesting. That really reflects just people are confused and they don't want to, I don't know. Do I want a tablet? Let me get one that does everything. Or is there really, that's what I want?
There's an awful lot of choices out there, and a lot of people make their choices on the basis of whatever random factor, including price,
right.
including availability. Right.
Including what ad they saw last.
What ad they saw right. in the Sunday paper, yeah. you know, if they still read Sunday papers.
Yeah.
But I think there really is a genuine business case there for people who are using a computing device for work and for personal,
I see.
That dual use kind of thing.
It's a hybrid.
You can take that thing and you pull the keyboard off of it and you're sitting on the couch and interacting with Twitter as an 18 inning baseball game is going on.
Holy cow. Yes.
You know, and so you can do that, or, you know, you reattach the keyboard and you're sitting in a hotel room, trying to get a PowerPoint presentation done at 2 a.m.
It is a little bit of acknowledgement, though, that Windows is most important to the enterprise, right? That's where they really focused.
I don't think there's ever been any lack of acknowledgement of
that.
They
know that.
I think Windows 8 was a big misstep with that, though. I would actually disagree with you there, Ed. I think that Windows 8 was them thinking that they could dictate how the enterprise would move forward. And I think, you know, Sanofsky, who was so gung-ho about the ideas of Windows 8, and on paper, you know, I think they looked really great. And then we all seen the feedback in the early previews. And you know, it was funny. I remember when we were preparing our coverage for Windows 8, and I was really, really kind of like, I don't know, guys, I think this is going to be a bigger bust than we're thinking. And some of the people I was working with were like, no, this is going to be huge. And I was like, no, we need to start prepping how to get the start menu back, like articles. Like, we need to start on this. I know that this is going to start happening.
But Mashable is very consumer focused, right?
We are. But what I'm saying, though, is that we also, I think that there's actually a lot that goes in hand with the consumers who don't like change and the enterprises that don't like change. I think there's actually a whole lot of crossover there. And the focus was so much consumer side on Microsoft's part. And when that didn't work, and they were kind of trying to push that into the enterprise part, which, you know, didn't want to be, you know, encumbered by some of the start screen stuff and some of the, you know, artists formerly referred to as Metro, you know, the modern design stuff. That was a real step back, and that put, you know, kind of a lot of the goodwill that they'd built up after Vista with 7 on the back burner for a lot of places. Because I talked to a lot of of businesses who were really buying tons of iPads and were happy to start building iPad-centric, you know, software for their salespeople, but were not at all impressed with Windows 8 because they saw it as kind of a kludge and it was confusing to their users. And the IT people just didn't want to be bothered because it was confusing to the users. They didn't want to bother with it.
It's got to be a little frustrating because there's no perfect solution. iPad's not a perfect solution.
No, it's not.
An end in itself. Maybe they weren't happy with Windows 8. If you look at the stats, Windows 7 is about half of the installed base.
Yeah.
XP is 25%. Windows 8 is 12%.
Right. And I mean, I think that honestly, I mean, I look at Windows 10 as almost an acknowledgement that there can be one operating system for everything strategy.
Well, that's the other thing that I find fascinating. This one product, one platform, one store thing.
Yeah, and
what the hell is that all about?
I'm going to call BS on it until we see it because we've been hearing this since the Java days, and it never works.
Nadia Sattel said this, and it was a kind of a shock. And then Microsoft backtracked, but maybe he did mean one Windows.
Ed,
what do you think? I mean, what do you think about that?
What about the whole
one Windows thing? Yeah.
Well, it's
that's genuine.
You know, when Steve Jobs introduced the iPhone, he held it up and said, "And it runs iOS." I mean, it runs
OS 10. Yeah,
it runs OS 10,
which it didn't.
And well, which it didn't. But in a way, he was saying one OS.
Yeah, you already know how to use it.
Sure.
Yeah,
because the kernel is the same, and a lot of the directions of application development and user experience on Apple's desktop and Apple's touch-oriented devices are converging on the same place. So they started with two different operating systems built on the same kernel with similar user experience guidelines that converge somewhere into the future.
That's what people really want.
And Microsoft is doing the same thing, but they've taken a different path to it. And I think, you know, Christina, you're right about the tactical errors. There were profound tactical errors in the launch of Windows 8. But strategically, Microsoft needed to accomplish two things. It needed to get its enterprise customers off of XP and onto a modern operating system. And I think they knew that that was going to be Windows 7. That's the long-term support version. And so they succeeded in doing that. And they thought that they could build this consumer-focused thing and then converge them in the future. And, you know, I think just as you did, I looked at it when it came out and I said, this is going to be jarring and uncomfortable for people, and there's going to be a lot of people who are going to reject it. And it played out exactly as we thought it was going to play out.
So but what about the convergence? What about the Windows 10? Now it's time to bring the paths together. Is this going to be it?
I think there's a bit of marketing in the convergence part. One thing that you get is the opportunity for developers to build universal apps and to sell them so that they can be licensed and used on multiple screen sizes and multiple OSs across multiple locations. That's probably the biggest advantage of the one Windows thing is, you know, if I'm selling an app, communications app or a social media app or something like that, I don't want people to have to go and pay for it all over again every time they go to a different location. I want them to be able to pay once and use it anywhere.
And Microsoft's so leading the way with that with Office, right? That's kind of how Office works.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a subscription, you know, kind of offering too, and that works really well. I guess to play devil's advocate, I would say I think that the idea behind one Windows and one, you know, core kernel, one core kind of set of libraries that can be shared across things, core set of you know, user interface things that can be shared across, data that can be shared across, that's great. Except we haven't seen anybody embrace, you know, modern apps on any sizable level. Any big companies bring out modern apps, at least that you charge for on any large level at all. I mean, Microsoft doesn't even have the modern version of Office out. And so I'm genuinely like curious, you know, I don't want to be a hater, but I'm genuinely curious, like at what point do we just say this is really great in theory, but is anybody actually going to change how they're developing software? Are they going to build the apps that will run on the phone? Are they going to build phone apps that can also run on the desktop? Are they going to build the game stuff that can go everywhere? Or are they going to continue to do what they've been doing, which is to have siloed out stuff where you're building your application for Windows for the traditional desktop as you always have? Maybe you're doing some sort of, you know, web interfaces and maybe some APIs so that your libraries can talk to one another, but they're not building something for this store environment. And that's what I'm not convinced about. And that's, I guess, why I hear this one Windows stuff and I go, yeah, but we've been hearing this for years and no one's actually bothered to build anything for it.
Yeah, but maybe the time wasn't right. Maybe now this is the step they need to take. We're going to take a break and come back. I want to ask also, Ed, why Windows 10 instead of Windows 9? That's kind of, and maybe that was just, I'm sure there's good reasons, but it seems like that got all the attention instead of all these other things that really probably Microsoft would rather be talking about than the numbering of the product. Right. We got Ed Bott
here. Let's see if I can get this camera working.
All right, we're having a little technical difficulty with Ed. We're going to get him back online. He's using Windows 10, so that's a brave thing to do. You sure you want to keep doing that, Ed?
It's easy enough to switch.
We're going to give you a moment to decide. Also, Christina Warren from Mashable. We're talking tech. We'll talk more about Microsoft. It is the third anniversary today of the passing of Steve Jobs. We'll talk a little bit about that and a lot more. Maybe now that the dust has settled, iPhone 6 stuff, too. Our show today brought to you by a great place. If you are looking to fill that position perfectly, ZipRecruiter.com. It solves a problem a lot of us have, which is, which job board do you use? There are so many, and each one has different, you know, audience, different kind of people that you might be talking to. Posting on 50 different job boards is a lot of trouble unless you use ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter lets you post once and get your listing on 50-plus job boards, plus Twitter and Facebook and Craigslist, everywhere you want. Post once, distribute everywhere. You'll be able to find candidates in any city nationwide. Watch those qualified candidates roll into their easy-to-use interface. That's important, too, by the way. You're going to get submissions, and ZipRecruiter makes it a lot easier to sort through them and find the right person. It all starts with a single click at ZipRecruiter.com. And by the way, you're going to love it. No juggling emails, no calls to your office. You quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. It is a great solution for anybody who's got to fill that position fast with exactly the right person. You can even create jobs pages and career pages that look just like your website with your branding. ZipRecruiter.com. Find out why more than 250,000 businesses have used ZipRecruiter. You'll love it. That's why we're giving you a free 4-day trial at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. ZipRecruiter.com/twit. I bet you 4 days is enough to get that right person right in there. We used them, and we're very happy with the results. ZipRecruiter.com/twit to try it free for 4 days, and we thank them for their support of this week in tech. Ed Bott, is he back yet? Should I have done that? Should I have taken longer to do the ad? We're still working on getting it. What were you thinking? You know, Paul Thurrott does this to me, too. Oh, I got the new Surface Pro. Let's see how this works. You guys, I guess you have to dog food your stuff. You got to, you know, if you're going to talk about it, you have to use it. I love Tim Moynihan's article on Wired Magazine. He says, ambitious Windows 10 is an attack designed as a retreat. He, like many, feels, you know, observed that, and I certainly felt like, oh, it's Microsoft's giving up on this whole new UI. But it isn't really. I think, it's an interesting, is it a pivot? Is it a retreat? I don't know if it's an attack. He says Windows at its best is most boring. Is its most boring as a blank napkin for productivity? Well, maybe. Why, Ed? Are you there? Yeah, we got him now. Now we don't have his audio. Yeah, we hear you. Good.
Okay.
Why 10? I saw one speculation that at first
I saw that was too.
At first I thought no, and then I thought yeah. Then now I'm thinking no again. Which is that programmers in the days of Windows 95 and 98 and XP would do a check on Windows 9 star to see if it was 95 or 98 to check for compatibility. And Microsoft might be afraid that a lot of that code which is probably the case, is still out there, and it wouldn't work with Windows 9. Is that credible at all? No.
It's vaguely, barely credible.
Well, it plays on the fact we know Microsoft pays a lot of attention to legacy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think it's more a matter of numerology. in all seriousness, if it's Windows 9, it's just another version.
Yeah.
And everyone's going to say, no, let's wait for Windows 10. This one, they really and truly did say, or the meta message they were sending was, this is the last one. Everything that will be beyond this is an incremental update to it. And there'll be...
That's interesting.
And there won't be a Windows 11. OS X was introduced in, what, 2001?
Right.
Yep.
Right around...
2001. And now we're at 10.10, which is
very confusing.
They don't like to say that. They even say to me, they're like, we're just calling it OS X Yosemite. I'm like, OS 10.10 Yosemite? They're like... Christina, stop.
Yeah, too many tens.
Too many tens.
OS 10, 10.10 is actually what the full name would be.
That is what the full name is, 10.10. Yeah. And I can't wait for 10.10.10. I mean, just, yeah, it's getting ridiculous. My friend John Marshall, who's Icon Master on Twitter, he said what I think is the funniest thing that's also probably true. He said that the reason they called it Windows 10 is because 9 is too close to 8. And they want to get as far away from 8 as possible in people's mind.
I like somebody else said it's because 7, 8, 9.
Yeah,
that was actually the official joke at the event.
I like it.
Dad humor.
It's dad humor. It's high school Ubik humor or dad humor. But really, come on, this is a big. This is a grown up company. Do they really think 10 is fooling anybody? It's the next version.
Yeah, but I think Ed's right, though. I mean, numerology is a real thing. I mean, I think when you go, I mean, BlackBerry kind of, I mean, okay, they failed, but they tried to do the same thing with going from, BlackBerry 7 to BlackBerry 10, and now I think they're going from Bez 10 to Bez 12. There is something about going into, a big, firm, two-digit version number that signifies this is for real, and this is a really big deal.
But nobody thinks that Microsoft had been working on 10 or 9 and decided, oh, we'll make it one better. Everybody knows it's the next version.
But to be fair, I mean, have they ever been great at branding? I mean, we went from 3.11 to Windows 95 to 98 to Millennium Edition to 2000 to XP to Vista to 7 to 8.
I mean, that's a good point.
Plus, there's been NT 4.0, 4.5. There's been all this stuff.
Somebody told me the internal numbering is 6.2. Is that right?
6.4. Yeah. Yeah. Windows Vista was 6.0.
Okay.
Windows 7 was 6.1. Windows 8
6.2.
Windows 8.1, I think, was 6.3.
Is it because it's an odometer number? It's like 10? Call it Windows 1000.
No.
Call it Windows 10,000. What?
It's a brand.
It's a brand.
It's a brand name.
It's not a number. It's a brand.
The version
that's,
number.
By the way, already used by Apple. Do they have no pride?
Exactly.
Do they have no pride?
And BlackBerry.
Well, they were going, look, they're on a yearly release schedule. If they did Windows 9 this year, they would do Windows 10 next year. One year later.
Wait a minute. Are they on a, what do you mean they're on a yearly release schedule? You just said it's 3 years since Windows 8.
They did 8. They did 8.1.
8.1 update.
And 8.1 update. Yeah, I mean, so they're already, these really should have been, from a consumer point of view, these are big, somewhat momentous releases.
Right.
And the branding is just bizarre.
It's just, from my point of view, it's just one more version of Windows I won't buy. But anyway, that's just me. I'm a bigot, and I admit
it. If you go back and look at all of their commercial messaging, it's all based on the latest version of Windows.
Yes.
The latest version of Office.
It's the best version of Windows we've ever made. Might as well steal that from Apple,
too. That's not what I'm talking about. Oh. They're trying very deliberately not to use
a number.
Version name.
It's just Windows.
Numbers with anything.
That's the new thing. Windows. By the way, if they want to be hip, all the kids today know version number at all. It's just the iPad.
And most people see we live in a tech bubble.
Yes.
We know things about version numbers and branding
right.
and stuff.
Most people just go,
right. They buy a PC and they use it for 4 years. They buy an iPhone, they use it for 2 years. They buy their latest Android device, they use it for a while. Updates show up, they accept them, they don't accept them. If something goes wrong with the update, they call their most technically sophisticated friend, or they go online right. and try and figure out
it's
what went
Windows.
Wrong with it.
I don't know what version.
But the
yeah.
number, I just have the latest version.
No, I know that. On the radio show, I'll ask people what version of Windows you're using. They go,
like,
I don't know.
I don't know. Same with my dad.
They have to look. So there's nothing to be said about 10. It's just the number. It's just the next version. And maybe this was intentional, maybe unintentional. It seems like much of the press attention has been on the number. Was that? I mean, really, that's not. Is that what they wanted? Oh, good. Let's everybody focus on the number.
Well, I mean, I think that they very clearly by going with a different number, I think to Ed's point, it's very clearly going for a different brand, and they're making a big statement. Whether they want to acknowledge that maybe it's because Windows 8 didn't work, maybe it's just because they're going in a different direction or what it is. I mean, but it's very clearly making kind of a different definition. I mean, they even joked about saying, "Oh, we could have called it Windows 1, you know, kind of like Xbox One and whatnot." But oh, we've already done that.
I thought they might do that actually.
I did too, actually, and I think that would have won Windows. I mean, that's been kind of That's kind of their longstanding philosophy. But I think that, yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of discussion around the name. But I think there's also been kind of a discussion about the fact that this is in a greater sense, a return to what they're really good at, which is kind of what Satya Nadella has been really saying his whole time as CEO, is really kind of trying to get back to their roots and get back to what Microsoft knows it's good at and really pushing that forward rather than maybe trying to be everything to everyone, which I think is a good thing because Microsoft is really, really good at being Microsoft. But it's where they falter sometimes, I think, is when they try to branch into areas where maybe they're not as adept. And that's where we all kind of suffer. But I mean, you'd be hard pressed to say that there's a better Office suite out there than Office 365. And I think that for a lot of people who are managing, you know, thousands of computers, you'd be hard pressed to say that there's a better client, you know, workstation system than, you know, Windows 7 or presumably Windows 10. And so they do a lot of things really well, but it's just when they kind of try to get out of that bubble and go into other areas where they falter some.
What is Microsoft really good at? What is the positioning that Microsoft would like to tell the world? Ed, what do you think? If you were sitting in the corner office.
Whoa.
Something wrong? I just promoted you to CEO of Microsoft. Okay. Did you get a big hit of noise or something?
Right back.
Uh-oh. All right, we're going to take a moment. Windows 10. Love it. This is the same thing with Paul Theriot. These guys have to use the latest stuff. I don't know why he has to use it on us. What are you using, Christina?
Yosemite. But it's in GM now. So
I just got it when I was gone. My Mac rebooted and I got... I guess so. The Goldmaster means we've got this. Is it? This is what this is going to come out.
Yeah, I mean, there probably will be. I'm thinking there will be one more update. But this is like the Goldmaster, you know, candidate.
For you know how release. I know this is real because they changed the About OS 10 box finally.
They did. And I mean, it feels pretty stable. I've been using it. Apple gave me a review machine to use through the beta process, but at this point, I've now actually got it running on everything. Now that the GM is out. So
I have to say the last version, I'm using it on my Mac Pro, the last version really felt sluggish. I have a very high res, you know, that 4K display.
Yeah.
It felt really sluggish and something, they fixed it, whatever it was. I don't know whether it was debugging code in there or they really were having performance issues or they hadn't tuned it yet. But boy, this feels good. This feels like it's ready.
It really does. There were a couple of the betas that, especially the 4K stuff, that didn't feel quite as good. But now, I mean, it feels solid. And they've done a good job with it. I've enjoyed using it. It was I kind of felt bad for Microsoft because Apple decided to release the GM of OS X
Yosemite.
No, during the presentation.
During. Literally,
as soon as the presentation started, they released the GM, and I was like, really, guys?
Do you think that's an accident, or do you think that these guys? These guys are sniped. They all do this.
No.
Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Apple. They're like, grow up.
It was an accident. Come on. No.
Grow up.
No, it was not an accident. I kind of agree because it makes it hard for us because we're trying to cover both things at once. I'm like, I don't have time, you know?
But October 16th, according to Recode, and John Pachkowski is pretty good on this stuff, will be. And it, you know what? We already know because Jim Dalrymple, the Loop, said it's not October 21st. October 16th will be the day that Apple ships Yosemite, right?
Yeah, that's what it seems like. It seems like that might also be the day they have an iPad event.
Event.
So we'll get the gold iPad with the Touch ID and faster processor and maybe, knock on wood, a new Apple TV. We'll see.
That's how bad it's gotten at Apple that the new iPad, it's gold.
Basically.
Oh, well, it's going to have Touch ID. Touch ID is good.
Touch ID is awesome. But let's also be honest. I mean, the iPad Air to me is the best tablet I've ever owned.
It's done.
It's fantastic.
Why can't we in this industry just say something's done? It's not. That's it. It's got everything. We're not going to make it better. It's done.
I mean, I feel like, honestly, I do feel like from a design perspective, you can update the specs, you can make the guts better, but I feel like it's the same way once they got to the current MacBook Air design, which I guess they did, I think, in 2010, 2011.
Yeah,
and it's,
that's cooked.
And it's perfect. You get to a certain point with the design that you can't make it any better. I feel like the iPad Air is that point for this iPad. I don't know how you can make that any better. From a design perspective, I feel like it's done. You can update the guts, you can add Touch ID, but the design itself, it's perfection.
So now we got Ed Bott back. We thought we'd just talk about Apple while we were gone.
So that was, and believe.
Oh, no.
Now it's something else. Now it's his audio. We don't hear you yet.
Okay.
I heard that. There.
No, this is not Windows 10. This is actually, there's a short in the microphone.
Apparently. Oh, all right. Okay. Cool. I just want to point out Apple earbuds, ladies and gentlemen. So
these are Marley earbuds.
Oh, they look just like Apple. Marley? I never heard of Marley. Is that a good thing? Something I should know about? Marley?
Bob Marley?
Marley. Is it Bob Marley?
It's the Marley Estate, yes. That did all these.
You know
these
that Dr. Dre making lots of money on the headphones, man. I got to do that.
It's a little cork.
Put cork on it. That make it cool.
No, they're actually really nice. The stuff they do with them. They did something with Motorola, didn't they, Ed? I think.
High margin business. I should be making freaking Twit headphones.
You should, Leo. You're not even joking. I mean, I know.
No, I should.
I remember when I worked in retail. We would automatically get a 50% off discount on anything Bose. But I remember the markup on certain audio equipment sometimes was up to 90% for certain brands, 90% markup. And that was the employee price, which means that there was even greater markup than that. So, I mean, for home audio, for car audio, for, you know, personal audio, the markup is insane, I think that's why I was. To me, it made sense for Apple to buy Beats because that thing is a cash cow that just has no signs of stopping. And the margins on that stuff is better.
Except that some analysts said that the margin on Beats had disappeared once they stopped having Monster make them and started trying to make their own headphones.
Well, and that might have been true, maybe the huge margin, but I guarantee you that with Apple supply chain contacts any advantage that Monster had, Apple has, you know, 10 times. I guarantee it.
Windows 10. Just one more thing. You say in your review, and by the way, Ed has a really good review on his ZDNet blog. You say that this is designed primarily to make life easier for mouse and keyboard aficionados. It's the return of the desktop, basically.
Yes. And so what's interesting is that, like I said, there's going to be multiple milestones along the way. And this is the one where, if you take Windows 10 and install it on a touch-capable device that you've learned to use with Windows 8.1, you're going to go, what happened?
Right. They took my touch out.
Where did all my good stuff go?
Yeah. No more charms?
The charms are still there on a touchscreen device. They're just, that all works as expected. There's no
Metro version of Internet Explorer. There's no touch-friendly version of Internet Explorer. There's just one browser in this technical
preview. That's a relief, because that was crazy, having two different browsers with two different UIs. Yeah.
Well, here's my problem with that, is that they lived in two different worlds. So if you had a website open in the touch version and then you went to the desktop version, the website wasn't open there. Right. So your tabs didn't, it was the states were completely separate. That is what drove me nuts. Yeah. That to me was like what was unconscionable. Like if you want to have two different interfaces, fine, but at least let my websites live in both places. Having them be completely separate, to me, I was like, you know what? I can't do this, Microsoft. Sorry.
So the rumor was, Ed, that they were going to sense what you were on and be appropriate to the device you were on. Is that what they're doing?
Well, that's not just a rumor. That's actually something that they showed off in a mock-up. Well,
remember, I've been in London. That was the rumor before they showed it. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's coded. It's not coded into the technical preview. But the idea is, and again, this is intended for those convertible devices, those two-in-one devices, right. So that and they did, if you can, I think I might have linked to it in that article, but maybe I didn't, but they did a video and they showed how it would work if you take a Surface or an HP X2 or HP one of those convertible devices, a Lenovo Yoga, and you switch it from, you either remove the keyboard or switch it into tablet mode, and their goal is for some interface affordance to come up and allow you to say, okay, I want to be in tablet mode now, and that would make the touch targets bigger, and so on. And then when you reattach the keyboard, you could say, no, I want to be back in mouse and keyboard mode now, where the touch targets get smaller because you've got a fine precision pointer that you can go after them with, and you can take advantage of richer apps. It's, you know, that's a really fine problem to solve, and a really difficult problem to solve. So it will be enjoyable at the least to watch how this develops. I mean, it could be a train wreck, or it could be a thing of beauty, and you just don't know.
Larry Dignan, before the event, gave some strategic goals for Microsoft. He said that Windows, he said 9, but 10 needs to be a cloud jump-off point, keep Microsoft relevant, be the last of Microsoft's big bang releases, entice the enterprise to remain Windows-based, and advance Microsoft's mobile ambitions. Those do seem like kind of big goals that Microsoft needs to focus on. Do you think that this does that job? Acknowledging that Larry's your boss.
it was a brilliant post.
Brilliant piece. No, but this does seem exactly right. In fact, it's kind of some of the stuff we've already touched on.
Yeah, it is. They need to circle the wagons in a sense for enterprise customers. They don't want to. There really aren't a lot of options for enterprise customers out there. So the question isn't to keep them from going elsewhere. The question is to keep them happy and in the fold.
Right.
And so you're going to see, so what you didn't see in terms of the name and the start menu and stuff, you didn't see a lot of the security features that are coming in. One thing that was leaked in a blog post from a Microsoft employee, it was pulled about 2 hours later when somebody came to him and said, you weren't supposed to publish that stuff, but he published a detailed list of the enterprise features that are going to be in there. And so there's a lot of multi-factor authentication stuff,
good,
for example,
good,
that's going to be baked into the core authentication of the operating system, not a layer that's added on, but baked in there. The ability to compartmentalize data on a device, so that if you bring a personal device into work, your management using lightweight device management tools, the same thing that they use to manage iPads and phones now, they can use that to compartmentalize the data on your device, so that when you leave employment, they can zap the work files and not touch your personal files or apps at all. And those are the kind of problems that people are looking to solve in the enterprise today.
It's funny, because those are problems that the mobile platforms have been trying to solve exactly those problems.
Well, everything's becoming a mobile platform. Right. You know, really, the screen is just an endpoint, and you know, the idea of how you get, whether you get to it on a laptop or on a big tablet or a small tablet or a smartphone, you know, you should be able to get to the back end that has the thing that you need to do, and control it from whatever endpoint you happen to have, whatever the size of it happens to be.
That's, I guess, getting back to my original question, which is how important is the desktop anymore? And it's just one kind of avatar of what you're actually doing. It's an abstraction to what's really there, which is your data. And it seems to me that Microsoft has to, and I think is probably knows this and is working very hard to do this, has to really have a strategy that goes across all these different, I hate to use the word avatar, but that's kind of what it is, this kind of realization of what is at core, which is your actual work, the data you're doing. So mobile, desktop, tablet, and it sounds like they want to own all of these instantiations of it.
Right? They want to be playing in all of those. Whether they can own them or not, I don't think. There's sort of a cult of monopoly in Silicon Valley where you're only successful if you have at least 90% market share.
Right.
You know, so that, oh my God, Apple only has 31% share selling $700 devices, each with a profit margin of 30%, you know, in a market of a billion devices. You know, you don't need a monopoly to be a significant player.
Does Microsoft understand that, coming from this being this monopoly company for two decades?
I think they understand it extremely well. I think they understand how lucky they were to get the desktop monopoly, and they understand how difficult it is to get the monopoly or to get a meaningful share, a meaningful market in mobile devices.
So plays well with others has got to be a big part of that overall strategy.
Well, that's a part of their overall strategy. Yeah. It certainly isn't Google's strategy, and it's not Apple's strategy.
Right.
Apple is plays well with anyone who plays well with us, and Google's strategy is plays well with us.
And you plays well with your data. All right, we're going to take a break. Ed Bott is here. He's now fixed the short circuit underneath his table. What are you are you using a USB interface? Is that what it is?
It's the Yeti microphone, headphones plugged into that,
right?
And it just blew you out, nice little crackling in the ears there.
Well, it's good you're using the Marley headphones, man, because that insulates you against it. It's not Bob, it's Ziggy.
I think it's the Marley estate.
Ziggy's kids getting old. Also here from Mashable, Christina Warren. And we're talking about the week's tech news. Our show today brought to you by Squarespace. There's the good news on Squarespace. You don't have to worry about fads, what's happening on the web. It's changing so fast. I just saw that one of our favorite Web 2.0 companies got sold. And I think somebody wrote an article saying it's the end of Web 2.0. This stuff moves so fast. Adaptive Path is now part of... It's just crazy. You don't have to worry about that with Squarespace because they take care of that for you. It's something we've really experienced in designing our own websites. Every 6 months, there's a new, now you got no more hamburgers. Can't have a hamburger. You got to have the parallax view. You got to have the big images. No more. This is it. You don't have to worry anymore. Your data is separate from your design. Your designs are state-of-the-art. Every Squarespace template is written to take advantage of the latest web technologies like responsive design, so your site looks good on all sites. And when that new trend or fad comes out, you don't have to worry. The Squarespace engineers, they'll be on it, and so will your website. Squarespace is the best hosting plus the best software, an all-in-one platform that makes it easy for you to create a website. You worry about your content or your business or what you're selling or your portfolio. Let them worry about the crazy stuff that's going on in the internet. Make your website state of the art. Separate content from display. Do it right with Squarespace. And by the way, if you need some help, they've always had the best support 24/7 from their own offices in New York. They've never outsourced it. There's a completely redesigned customer help site, self-help articles, video workshops, webinars, and e-commerce available on all plan levels. That means you can sell stuff, but you can also accept donations, which is great for nonprofits. You could do a cash wedding registry, a school fund drive. And all of this starts at $8 a month. That includes a free domain name when you sign up for a year, and they'll wire it all up for you. Great apps like the Metric app for iPhone and iPad that lets you check site stats, unique visitors, social media followers. The blog app makes it easy to update and monitor comments. The code is gorgeous underneath. You are getting state-of-the-art stuff. If you're a photographer, you got to take a look at their Portfolio app, which takes your photos from the website and puts them on an iPad or iPhone suitable for display to your clients. So they've even got workflow built into this. It's just so cool. And always updated with the latest, greatest stuff. Always secure. Squarespace.com. Try it free. You don't need a credit card. Just go to squarespace.com. Click the Get Started button. You'll be able to use it. Use the site completely free, no credit card or anything. For 2 weeks, you get the run of the place. You can even import your existing data and see how that feels in there. I think you're going to like it. All I ask, when you decide to buy, use the offer code TWIT, and you'll get 10% off. And they'll know you saw it on This Week in Tech. Squarespace.com, offer code TWIT, the next place to start your website. Squarespace. Yeah, I mean, Adaptive Path is an interesting story. It was a company that really created Web 2.0. And Wired says, Adaptive Path and the death rattle of the Web 2.0 era. Who did they sell to? Capital One, like the credit card company.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell is that?
So weird.
really everybody used it. Merlin, man, everybody we know, they all had Adaptive Path, and everybody used them, and they were like, they would tell you how to make your site usable. They would UI design and stuff. They say, we're not going to take any more customers. All of our attentions are going to Capital One from now on. Wow. I'm feeling old. All right. Speaking of feeling old, it's been exactly 3 years to the day that Steve Jobs passed away. That was a very sad day here. We were interviewing. Who were we interviewing? We're doing triangulation. Kevin Marks, right?
Kevin Marks.
Who had worked at Apple, had worked for Steve Jobs. When the news came that Steve had passed, everybody knew he was very sick. He had already stepped down as CEO of Apple. Still a real shock. Tim Cook sent out an email to Apple employees on Friday. Team, Sunday will mark the third anniversary of Steve's passing. I'm sure that many of you will be thinking of him on that day, as I know I will. I hope you will take a moment to appreciate the many ways Steve made our world better. His vision extended far beyond the years he was alive, and the values on which he built Apple will always be with us. Enjoy your weekend. Enjoy your weekend, especially for those of you who will be working here all weekend long. And thanks for helping carry Steve's legacy into the future. One of Steve's legacies, we learned from Dom Melton's interviews on the Debug podcast, Renee Ritchie's great podcast on iMore, was that the weekends really weren't weekends for Apple employees, especially executives, because Monday was the big meeting day, and you had to have everything ready for your boss to bring to Steve on Monday. So Sunday nights were extremely high pressure for Apple employees. I wonder if that culture has changed. As we remember all those great things about Steve, he was also a tough man to work for, I think.
But is that different from any other company?
Is it or not?
And any successful?
You tell me.
Not when you get into the executive ranks of a big tech company today.
You work 24/7.
Yeah. If you don't do it, you get your lunch eaten.
Right.
I think the difference here was that it wasn't just the execs, it was all the underlings too. And I've talked to a lot of people who were on, Craig's team and on Scott's team and on the, Mac and the iOS side, and who had to do those presentations, and their bosses were the ones who were obviously up all night, but then the people below them had to be up all night too. And so it kind of became part of the culture where everybody, in Don's interview and the other, people who former employees were kind of alluding to that, was that, you kind of got mad at the people who worked below you if they got a good night's sleep and you didn't. So it kind of permeated from the top top down.
Melton says that was really sad when The Sopranos ended because
you
knew when The Sopranos was on. Scott Forstall loved The Sopranos. You knew you would have 1 hour so you could go to the bathroom, have a conversation with your family, whatever. But after The Sopranos ended,
there goes our
hour.
Right, which, I mean, and I don't know if it's that way at Google or not. You know, I mean, I hear mixed things. And the...
Probably depends who your boss is there, right?
I was going to say, I think that that's one of the big differences is that at Apple, you know, especially if you were... I mean, at Apple, I think what's different about versus how it is at Google is that at Apple, the designers are kind of king and they kind of sit above where the engineers are, whereas at Google, obviously, the engineers are king. And the hierarchy is much more flat, I think, at Google versus at Apple. So, but you know, I mean, it differs from company to company. I think you could make the argument that I don't think that at Yahoo, for instance, I don't think there are a lot of people who would get, you know, feel compelled to be up until 4 o'clock in the morning, a Sunday night. And that's not really a criticism of Yahoo. I just think it's a difference. But you know, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of these consumer companies, I mean, yeah, if you want to make it, you've got to work sometimes these insane, ridiculous hours. But that's also, I think, one of the reasons why you see so much burnout from people, right? Because there's a certain point in your life where you're going, I can make this much money working, you know, for any number of companies. Do I really need to be doing this when I'm however old I am? And if I have a family, do I really need to be in a position where I can't, you know, go to bed until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning on Sunday night because I'm presenting to someone and my boss who never sleeps might be sending me an email that I've got to be ready for.
But if I'm Steve Jobs or I'm Tim Cook, I want that kind of employee, right? And those are the guys who can get promoted and.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you get promoted, but promoted to what, right? I mean, I think that becomes the big question.
Well, burnout's like an issue, of course.
Well, that's what I'm saying, because I mean, at a certain point, if you're doing this your whole life and your whole career, to what end? I mean, if everybody at the top is still having these sorts of work hours, then what are you working towards exactly?
Right.
If taking a vacation means you also have to check your email 4 times a day, and that, you know, I mean, that was one of their points, that on vacation you would say, oh, only 4 times, but you know, Dom was kind of secretly judging somebody. You know, he even admitted as much on that podcast. Oh, yeah. You know, you only checked email 4 times on vacation a day, and you're thinking
something wrong.
Okay,
with you.
Well, but you also kind of wonder, okay, well, maybe I just don't want to do this. I mean, there are a lot of jobs where you can make good money and get to have a life. And I mean, to me, that's kind of why I see some of the big perks that these companies offer, you know, notably Google and Facebook, as kind of being bad things, right? Because it seems to me like they're really just encouraging you to like live at the office and to make your entire social circle, your entire, you know, work life, everything revolves around the office. And you think, oh, it's so great. I can do my laundry here. You know, I can sleep here. I can eat here. I can do all this other stuff. But doesn't that at a certain point just mean that your entire life is your job? And I mean, maybe that's okay. Maybe that's what you want. But I think that for a lot of people, we like to have the idea, even if it's fake, that we can have lives beyond what we do.
Melton says, when someone came into my office and said they want to be a manager, I asked them, how did you sleep last night? They say, oh, fairly well. And I said, good, because that's the last good night's sleep you're going to get. Is it like that at Microsoft, Ed? I know it's not like that at ZDNet.
Well, it was like that at Ziff Davis.
Was it?
When I worked there,
Billy?
Absolutely.
Bill Ziff would call you in the middle of the night?
Bill, or...
Macrone?
Executives from Ziff Davis, you'd get that call in the middle of the night, and you'd be expected to respond to it.
It's funny, because I had a different take when I read this. I said, oh my God, this sounds horrible. And Lisa, our CEO here at Twit, said, what are you talking about? That's exactly how it should be. <It's> like, oh... Okay.
Well, I mean, I think that there's balance, right? I mean, like, there's certainly times where there's breaking news, I mean, all hands on deck. We all get on board and we do it. And it's kind of one of those things where, you know, people know that they can call me at 2 o'clock in the morning and I'll be waking up. You know,
but it does mean that major event happens. Startup culture is going to attract a certain kind of person, usually young, no family, no life.
Right.
That's who you're going to get.
That is. And I
devoted,
think that that's kind of
focused.
Right, because those are the people that can afford to give that sort of stuff up. It gets harder to make the decision to be able to put all of your life into that when you're older. I mean, I'm 31, but I have to say it would be harder for me. I'm married and I've been at this for a while to be willing to, you know, work, you know, 18-hour days for a job if I didn't have significant equity or I weren't building it out myself. But if I were just being hired as a cog in the wheel, I don't know if I'd be willing to do that, if I'm being honest. When I was 20, 21, 22, sure. But even just in the span of a decade, you know, things change because what you value in your life changes. And I think it's especially different if you, if you're married or if you have a partner, or, you know, especially if you have children, where you go, you know, I don't know if you want to give those sorts of things up in exchange for the perceived potential benefits. And that's why there are so many young people in startups. Sometimes I think to the detriment, because, you know, you, the startups could actually probably benefit from having people who are more experienced and have gone through things more and have a better perspective. But you just can't find people who have that sort of experience, usually, who are willing to give up their entire lives, you know, for the company, and to be in that kind of go, you know, working, you know, 18, 19 hours.
Not that new. Cause okay. So I was in London this week and, you know, visited the Tower of London and stuff. And actually, Westminster Abbey, where everybody's buried. And what becomes really apparent is that the British Empire became an empire upon the backs and the blood of millions of young men, mostly some women, who were willing to give their lives for this cause of the British Empire. This really isn't anything new, is it? I mean, you get glory, I guess this has always been the case. But then I think the people who buy these iPhones aren't really thinking about the blood, sweat, and tears that went into them, not just in Cupertino, but in China and everywhere else.
No, we don't like to think about that because that's really depressing.
Is that life?
Yeah, it is, and it's not. I think that there is a huge disconnect, though. There's a certain amount, I think, of disconnect when you have something like this, which costs a lot of money and that we see as a status symbol, and then you see how it's made. And there's a certain amount of guilt, as I think there should be, when you think about the sacrifices that go into being made, the people who are sourcing the materials, the people who are putting these things together. Not to mention, you know, I feel for some of the people who are building the software, but I'm not going to cry river for somebody who's making a six-figure salary by their choice. I'm going to cry and feel bad for the people that are being paid, you know, pennies an hour to put these things together, the people that are sourcing the minerals right. That make this stuff. But I think that that's kind of one of the, I guess, the interesting dichotomies with tech, at least for me, is that we are surrounded by all this amazing stuff that makes our lives so much easier. But at the same time, so many of those advantages come at the expense of real human capital. And that's not a fun thing to really address or look at. And I think that's why a lot of us don't, because it's very uncomfortable to kind of, you know, put those two things in juxtaposition. But it's something we probably should do more of.
It actually reminds me of the Tony Hsieh story that's going around about downtown mm-hmm. Las Vegas. Tony Hsieh, who is the former still CEO at Zappos, even after the Amazon acquisition. Really great guy. I love him. Wrote a book about bringing happiness to everyone and I thought this was a really interesting project, to revitalize downtown Vegas, to create startup capital funds down there and bring startups in there. And Hsieh just stepped down. 30 of the 300 employees have been laid off. And the worst thing is there have been 3 suicides this year by people involved with the downtown project. And of course, the headline in newspapers is it possible to be happy when you're trying to bring happiness to everyone? It's damaging. So this is another side of this. Hsieh says, hey, there's suicides all everywhere. You shouldn't focus on that.
Well, and I think that's a fair point, but it's also, I think, in that case, it's really, you have to kind of look at the big culture of things he was bringing in, where you're talking about a very stressful thing of having a startup. You know, my father he's retired now, but he was an entrepreneur. And I know what it was like growing up where, you know, my mom was kind of the stable breadwinner. My dad, you know, sometimes things would work out really well. Sometimes they wouldn't. And starting your own business, you know, is very difficult, whether it's a startup and you have funding, or you're starting a restaurant and getting a small business loan, or you're doing something
else.
It's, It's very tough, and most of them fail. The reality is most of them fail.
And it's hard on you? And it's hard on your family?
It absolutely is. And so you have a situation with the Downtown Vegas, the Downtown Project, where, yes, they had a lot of money where they're trying to revitalize this very downtrodden, very dilapidated, very crime-ridden area, and kind of trying to do a civic duty and also, you know, kind of trying to, you know, treat it kind of like a tech startup. So you convince a lot of people to leave their homes and their support systems, come to this new place that has its own issues, and then kind of, you know, power together through the spirit of, you know, kumbaya and build something bigger. And it's a great idea. And I certainly don't want to, you know, condemn the idea, but I definitely feel like that does become kind of a perfect storm in a sense for the problems that are going to exist anyway to only become even more exasperated once you look at kind of the situation of where you are, what the economy is like, what the people in the town are like, and then you've got all the other day-to-day, you know, really realistic struggles of starting a business, especially when the person that's leading kind of the command is this very charismatic leader who wants everyone to be happy, to the point that I feel like maybe that becomes a negative thing because you feel like, well, if I'm not on the outward looking like I'm happy, if I don't talk about my struggles, if I do talk about my struggles, maybe that's going against the message. And so maybe people don't feel comfortable to be open about what they're struggling with. And so, I mean, I think it's a real shame. And, but I mean, I think the Downtown Project, I mean, they obviously had to do some layoffs this week, and there's, we don't really know the whole story behind that, but I feel like that's, I don't know. I love the idea of trying to go into a downtrodden area and try to build it up and do good, but I don't know if you can apply some of the lessons that you do with a typical startup, if you can take that to civic planning. I don't necessarily know if the people who were in charge, what's been kind of coming out has been that maybe some of the people in charge of some of these things weren't the best people, you know, to be in charge. And you know, civic planning is hard enough. Doing startups is hard enough. Doing both of them together, I don't know. I mean, maybe it was too ambitious, but I hope that the project is able to be ultimately successful and that, you know, more that it can work out better, you know, going forward.
Yeah. I think Tony's a great guy and I know his heart, his heart is in the right place.
Oh, without a doubt. And I think he's done a lot for the Downtown Vegas community. I just feel like, you know, it's one thing to build a successful business. It's another thing to build a bunch of successful businesses and a community that can kind of build upon itself. And I mean, to his point, you know, he released a letter that said, you know, look, we knew this was a 5-year plan. You know, we're accelerating the typical process much faster. So there are going to be successes and failures that accelerate faster too. And that's a valid point. I just think that, you know, the narrative that we like to see as journalists and as storytellers and as people who follow the media, we want to see things happen in a certain way. And I think so many people went to Downtown Vegas and were kind of enamored with the process. And then when it doesn't work out, you know, become upset that it didn't work out. But I mean, we're only in the middle of kind of what they think their 5-year plan is going to be. And so I think his heart's definitely in the right place. And definitely I'm not willing to count these things out, but I think it's just proof to all of us that, you know, money alone isn't going to be able to create success. And that, you know, it's hard work to build a business and it's a hard work to build communities.
And there's a price paid by the people who choose it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We're going to take a break, come back with more. Bill Gates says Apple Pay is a good thing. Doesn't say why Microsoft didn't do it sooner. But first.
Ouch.
They tried. Or did they? I don't know. You know, they had a watch. They had that spot watch. It was awesome. We're going to take a break and be back with more in just a moment. Our show today brought to you by Audible.com. Here's something we can all agree on. The best way to relax and to seal out the world and all those 3 a.m. phone calls is an audio book. And I, as somebody who spent a lot of time on an airplane this week and last week too, I got to tell you, Audible is a lifesaver. You know, in England, there's Audible ads in the tube, in the underground station, everywhere, on the trains. And what was the slogan? I loved it. I can't remember. It was a great slogan, like, there's always time to listen or something like that. It was wonderful. It's true. If you commute, if you spend time in the car, if you spend time at the gym, if you just do housework, anything, there's lots of time in the day when you can't hold a book, but you could be listening to a book. And you'll be amazed. It brought reading back into my life when I started listening to Audible 14 years ago. I started in the year 2000 because, you know, we have busy lives. Who has time? But it turns out there's a lot of time where you could be listening, and Audible brings those books into your life. I'm right now, I'm listening to, I used to have this rule, one book at a time. I don't know how I got out of that, but now I have like three books going right now. One fiction, one nonfiction, and then maybe one random one. There's so much great listening at Audible. 150,000 titles recorded, not just by, you know, readers, but by actors, by people who bring these books to life in such a great way. And sometimes it's by the author. I just listened to the Neil Young autobiography, and he's reading it. That's really great. Not Neil Young. Well, that's one. Actually, there is a new Neil Young book. Graham Nash. And actually, the next one on my list is Neil Young, because I love the rock and roll stuff. I'm also about to listen to Gone Girl. You know, that movie's coming out, I think, this week. A thriller. But I got to tell you, as good as a two-hour movie can be, there's nothing to compare with the novel as you're listening to it. And this the plays out in your mind. Your mind makes the best sets. Sometimes I think, I've already seen this movie because I've read or listened to the book. And that's what... so if I always recommend, before you see the movie, get the book Gone Girl. Whew, yeah, absolutely. Don't know what the movie will be like, but I know you're going to love this book. Here's the deal. I'm going to get you two books free. What about that? All you have to do is go to audible.com/twit2. That's audible.com/twit and the number 2. You'll be signing up for the Platinum Plan. That's two books a month, plus the Daily Digest of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. Cancel anytime in the first 30 days. Those books are yours to keep forever. You pay nothing, but I think you're going to want to be a member for life. I know I am. I'm. That's it. Ooh, new Neil Gaiman. A full cast production of the Graveyard book. I haven't read this. Have you read the Graveyard book, Christina? Because it seems like you'd be a Neil Gaiman fan.
I am. I have not. I have not. But I saw Gone Girl yesterday, and the film is great. The film is fantastic. Okay. The book is amazing, too. And actually, the Audible version, it's like 20 hours.
Yeah.
It's a really, really good one.
Well, see, that's the thing. How could a two-hour movie get that all the nuance of a 19-hour novel?
You know what? Remarkably well. But it's 2 hours, 45 minutes.
Would you listen to the book first?
I would, but I would say that if you don't, Gillian Flynn adapted the novel. She also did the screenplay.
Okay.
So it's one of the rare times where I think Fincher in general is really good at adaptation, but she did a really good job with the script. But yeah, I would definitely listen to the book or read the book first if you have a chance.
See, one or the other is going to spoil it, right? Because then you'll know what's going to happen.
You're going to know, but it's one of those things where you will still enjoy it. My husband hadn't read the book and loved the film, and I loved the book and loved the film. And the entire theater, I mean, I'm not going to give anything away. It's kind of a thriller, but the entire theater, when it was over, I've never seen a full theater full of people literally have a WTF face. You know, everybody was just kind of sitting.
But see, I want that experience
silence.
With the book always first, and then I'll do it with the movie. You know, I can think that's personal. That's personal
sure,
preference.
Sure, definitely. No, yeah. I like to read the book first if I can.
I always definitely. Read the before I see the movie, I almost always try to read the book first. I just, for some reason, that's just how I am. Audible makes it possible. And I think your mind is better at creating scenes, building the set, making it happen. That's why, to me, science fiction, as much as I love those great sci-fi movies and TV shows, you got to read the book. The book comes to life, whatever it is. Peter F. Hamilton, Isaac Asimov. Great selection there, too, at audible.com. Try it today. Two books you're free for you, audible.com/twit and the number 2, audible.com/twit and the number 2. There's always, I think I said, there was always time to listen. Something like that. Oh, Lisa's happy because the Niners won. I thought she was cheering for Audible.
Spoiler alert.
I like Audible, too, she says. She's listening to Nora Roberts. I think you're going to go through all the Nora Roberts books and John Grisham. Yeah. She likes those thrillers. It's fun. And she's in the gym like 8 hours a day, so she really needs something to listen to. Bill Gates, interview with Bloomberg TV, Eric Schatzker, talked about a lot of stuff. Talked about Bitcoin. See, but Bill's slant has changed a little bit now that he's a philanthropist. He's not so interested in business. He's interested in how the world, especially for the poor, can be transformed. And he thinks, for instance, Bitcoin is huge for that. But he also thinks that virtual forms of virtual money and virtual payment are really important because, especially in the developing world, a lot of people don't have bank accounts. but they might have cell phones. They can't write a check, but they can pay by a cell phone. He says Apple Pay, this is a quote from the interview, is a great example of how a cell phone that identifies its user in a pretty strong way, I guess he's talking about the fingerprint, the Touch ID, lets you make a transaction that should be very, very inexpensive. So the fact that in any application I can buy something, that's fantastic. The fact that I don't need a physical card anymore, I just do that transaction, you're going to be quite sure about who's on the other end, and that is a real contribution. And all of the platforms, whether it's Apple or Google or Microsoft, you'll see this payment capability get built in. But he thinks Apple will help it get to critical mass for all of the devices. I think he's right. I think this is something we've been poised on the verge of. But Apple Pay is just going to be, I think it's going to be that final bit that puts us over the top, especially because of the Touch ID, which works very well on iPhones.
Well, and they also have a very deep connection to a very wealthy core demographic.
Right.
And so that
which
is
merchants would love to get to.
Exactly. And that's what makes it possible for the payment system to be successful, is because you know that people are going to be coming in with money on their phone that they can interact with. You know, and so
he also says it's Apple's in it for the money, not philanthropy, but it will spur philanthropy as well. It will help the economy of the developing world greatly.
No, I think he's right. I mean, it's interesting, actually, because if you look at the developing world, they've actually been further ahead, at least, than America when it comes to paying by phone.
Right.
They do it in different ways. You know, I remember speaking with Osama Badir, who was at PayPal at the time, and then he was at Google, and I'm not sure what he's doing now, but he was at the time PayPal's big payments guy, and he was telling me about how, I mean, this was probably in 2009 or 2010, you know, that a lot of people in Africa would have, you know, dumb phones and would use, you know, these kind of micropayments to buy things, kind of with, you know, individuals acting as kind of banks to transfer, you know, funds from one device to another. And that they were
the technology widely used now in Africa and India is M-Pesa.
Exactly. That same sort of thing. And so people buying things through SMS. And so I think, you know, bringing it to the developed world, it's needed in Apple. I mean, I think obviously NFC is not a new thing, but what hasn't happened in America anyway is that the merchants haven't gotten on board. And to Ed's point, you know, they will get on board when you know that you've got 10 million people buying an iPhone, you know, 6, you know, the weekend it comes out. And when you've got a few hundred million people with Touch ID, you know, capable devices who are going to be going into places like Whole Foods and, you know, Target and the Apple Store and other places to buy stuff. And that means that upgrading your equipment and your point of sale terminals makes more sense.
And we've talked a little bit about that on MacBreak Weekly, that the timing is critical because in the U.S., we're going chip and PIN by the end of 2015. That is a federal mandate.
Right.
Merchants will have to buy new credit card equipment anyway before the end of next year. So your timing is excellent. If you're a merchant, you're about to do this, well, you're going to make sure it works with Apple Pay. And obviously, since Apple still is not even half of the universe in the United States, you're going to make sure it works with Google Wallet and NFC and any other touch-to-pay system. And I'm sure that that's exactly what's happening, is the companies that make these devices are now making sure they're completely compatible with all the possible touch to pay stuff, and that's going to empower it. We were in a London taxi. They take touch to pay, many of the London taxis. I could have paid with it, my Google Wallet. I was like poised over it, but there's a hump to get over. It's like the first time you use a credit card online. There's just a little hump to get over.
I think that might be as much as anything an age related thing, Leo.
Are you saying I'm old, Ed Bott?
I am.
Well, you're
I'm saying we're old, buddy. But you know what I find fascinating is that the most widely developed, well developed, and widely implemented payment system so far is one called ISIS,
which was Verizon's attempt to get onto my phone.
And so it's now called SoftCard.
It's now called SoftCard.
Smart idea to change the name. Although the software is still called ISIS. I mean, I haven't had an update yet. Anyway,
but no, that's the one that the carriers and Verizon. So it's everybody but Sprint and then MasterCard and Visa, I think American Express.
Which was horrific because they kept Google Wallet off of all of their phones.
They did. I mean, that was why Google Wallet. I remember when I beta tested that and wrote a review of that. Gosh, at this point, it was 3 years ago. Like this month or last month, it was 3 years, you know, that I used that on a Galaxy Nexus, right, on Sprint. And I, you know, I connected my Capital One credit card to it, because that happened to work, and I was able to, but it only worked with the Capital One MasterCard. It wouldn't work with a Visa. It had to work with a MasterCard and only for a couple of payment carriers. You know, but
so is Ed right? Since Ed and I are old farts and you're young, are you comfortable with touch to pay? Is that something you do?
I don't have a card with a chip in it, and there aren't enough readers, but I definitely would feel comfortable with that. For me, the bigger hump has actually been, will this recognize my existing banking system, or do I have to go to another bank? The big thing I think that Apple has that was absolutely a requirement, and they obviously thought to do this, is that they are going to be coming out of the gate supporting Bank of America, Chase, you know, Citibank. All of the major banks are begging to get on board. And then, you know, MasterCard, Visa, American Express are all on board. And so when you've got that ability there, if I can very easily add my existing card to the wallet very easily, and I don't have to go through a bunch of hoops, which I had to do with Google Wallet and which you kind of have to do with ISIS, I think that even for people who are not maybe comfortable, if you can get over that hump of easily adding your card, just scanning your credit card and having it in the wallet, that's a lot easier.
I think I'll get comfortable very quickly. Just I need to do it a few times, and then just not much opportunity to do it. And I do think the Touch ID in an iPhone will make me feel better. Yes. I gather what happens with Wallet is you have to enter a PIN.
You have to enter a PIN, and then, you know, the NFC might be working, maybe it isn't, and right, it was clunky. It was clunky when they introduced it 3 years ago, and because of the ISIS back and forth, they never really got it off the ground. And it was just a shame,
Verizon,
because it was, seriously. But I mean, but it was a great, you know, first attempt. But when I was using it 3 years ago, I was like, there's no way this will go mainstream. Apple, for whatever reason, A, they're really lucky with the timing. As you said, people have to upgrade the machines anyway. But I think B, they aren't going to launch a product that is going to have that sort of experience. They're not going to do that. You know, they will wait until the ecosystem can be where it is now, because if it were just about launching a product, they could have launched something like Touch ID or Apple, you know, Pay a couple of years ago. But
in countries,
they're going to make sure they have people out there to do it.
In countries like Australia, where it's widespread, England, people are have you done it, Dad?
Have used electronic payments?
Yeah. I mean, touch to pay. No.
No, because
there's nowhere that does it.
Because the American banking system is almost as backward as the American mobile data networks.
It's true. It's true.
They're both, you know, as all you have to do is leave the borders of the United States to see what civilization should look like. And then you come back here and you just go, we have all these smart people and all these amazing companies and these horrible, horrible infrastructures. I mean, we were in Europe earlier, I guess last month, and I mean, I was embarrassed handing over a credit card. I'm sorry, you have to swipe this. I'm terribly embarrassed. And they'd say, that's okay, we understand, you're American. But we were horribly behind on GSM. The rest of the world adopted it wholesale long before us. And I think the rest of the world is going to benefit from electronic payments long before the United States does.
Yeah, no, I mean, Canada is, you know, they do the chip and pay, the swipe and pay stuff. And if I go to Canada, it's the same sort of thing. You feel embarrassed if you have to have them swipe the card. You know, I mean, at least there they'll take $20 bills, but, you know, it's, you know, for the most part, depending on what part of Canada you're in, they'll pretty much take up to a 20 and have the same conversion rate. But yeah, I mean, we are definitely way behind. I hope that Apple Pay is what pushes us to catch up, and that the other payments, it won't become the de facto standard, of course, but that will be what will force merchants to finally get on board.
As Gates points out, authentication really is the big issue, and having a comfort level with Touch ID and having that built in, that's going to, for me anyway, make me feel a lot better about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, with all the breaches and credit card breaches we've had over, you know, the period of time, it hasn't
been any worse than the system.
I was going to say, I mean, honestly, You know, I feel like NFC, if anything, RFID seems safer than, you know, the systems that have been going on.
Yeah, that's true.
And we really, we don't like to think about how unsafe our current credit card systems are, that they're being swiped and sometimes manually written down and that sort of stuff. The fact that anybody, you know, you give your number over the phone, you know, anybody could be writing that number down and putting it someplace else. I mean, our payment system as it exists right now is very insecure because we still are using these antiquated practices that the rest of the world kind of looks at us and they're like, really, guys? Really? I thought that you're like USA number one. It's like, yeah, not really.
Well, you know why? Because we are in the forefront of protecting consumers in that regard. And because consumers really don't pay, at least not directly, for any losses, the banks do. There's been very little pressure for consumers to come up with a more secure system. It's all coming from the banks.
The banks don't pay. They are able to push it on to the merchants. So if there's a, you know, a lot of times it goes back to the merchants.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah.
Who eat it. Oh, yeah. It's
so it's the merchants who should be saying, we want Touch to Pay.
They should be, except they don't want to pay for the upgrade of the systems.
Right.
Has been kind of the historical thing. They don't want to pay, you know, $1,500, $1,800 for a new terminal, you know, if you're a small business, which is why a lot of people, even after the Target hack, were fighting this, you know, federal mandate that we're all going to go, you know, chip to pay. But at this point, there have been enough problems that, yeah, I mean, they're going to have, everybody's going to have to upgrade. But even after that mandate comes through, you know that there are going to be tons of businesses, just like there are in Brooklyn, where there are tons of people who don't take credit card because they don't want to pay the taxes on it. You know, they take cash only, or, you know, they use things like Square, which are, you know, kind of a, you know, less expensive way of having to get around the system. So I don't know. We'll see.
So I'm looking at a Wall Street Journal article. They got it wrong, too. They've corrected the article. Apparently, you'll still be able to sign after October 2015, but you will have to have the PIN in your credit card, and it will be encouraged that people use chip and PIN as opposed to chip and sign, which is all
well, which is the same way it is in Europe.
Yeah, I could sign for stuff.
Civilized world right now.
Yeah.
You can still swipe and sign, but it's strongly encouraged.
Right.
And you're much better protected against fraud if you're using a chip and PIN system. I think the big cultural shift that we're going to have to make is starting to think of smartphones as like they literally are like your wallet.
Yeah.
You don't want your ticket. Yeah, you don't want your a pickpocket to take that from you because it's as valuable as a wallet filled with 20s and 100s.
Well, that's, again, where the fingerprint, where Touch ID gives you some reassurance. Apple has also improved their, I think this is great, their activation system. Now they have a tool that you can put on a phone and say, is this a stolen phone? They make it very hard, in fact, to steal a phone and then use it again. All of that stuff, it's more than a kill switch. I mean, it really kills it dead. All of that stuff really is important. And Apple really can lead the way, and I hope that Android devices will follow.
Oh, I think they definitely will. I mean, I just think that Apple, because they are, even if they have less market share than Android as a whole, when it comes to an individual company, they obviously have the most market share, you know, for a single type of device category. You know, more iPhones are sold than anything else. And so they have a huge opportunity at that point. But yeah, I mean, I think that you're absolutely right, Ed. I mean, we've got to start thinking of our phones like our wallets. And I mean, to be honest, I've lost my phone once and I was able to get it back, but it did feel like a violent. I mean, I felt the sort of sense of loss I felt not having my phone was akin absolutely to losing a wallet. And at this point, you know, there's as much personal data about me on my phone as there usually is in my wallet. I mean, maybe I don't have to, you know, go, you know, I don't, just as I don't carry my social security card with me, you know, maybe there are certain things on my phone that might not be as inherent to my identity, but losing one or both, it's basically kind of the equivalent. You feel screwed. You feel, you know, violated without either piece of information. But I think that the concept that we can just say, oh, it's just a phone. No, you know, your phone becomes this core part of you know, your identity in a large sense.
Ed, you were going to say something?
No. It's just had a short circuit in the mic again.
You know, here's an interesting sideline to this. According to this new law that it goes into effect October 2015, there's also a shift of who is liable for fraud. The the person with less technology is liable.
Right. And that's what they're trying to get people to upgrade. So yeah.
If there's card fraud, whichever party has the lesser technology will bear the liability. Wow.
That's smart.
Yeah, I guess.
No, I mean, I think that's probably the only way they can convince some of these merchants to upgrade is if it becomes a liability issue. And at that point, it would come down to, for some, you know, retailers, it would come down to, is our insurance that we have out against fraud, is that rider going to be more or less expensive than what we would have to pay to upgrade our systems?
Right.
And then it just comes down to whatever's cheaper they'll do. But I think that that's probably the only way you can get places that have, you know, hundreds of thousands of terminals to upgrade en masse, is if you start saying, okay, well, if you don't have this system in place, then if there is a breach, we will hold you responsible and you will be liable. And, you know, your insurance or whatever policy you've got into effect will have to be responsible for this.
Well, at the risk of being totally cynical, I'm going to predict that the regulations will be written in such a way that the banks win.
Yeah, what a surprise.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Banks will always have the moster technology, not the lesser technology.
And even if they don't, the rules will be written in such a way that their technology will be defined as the best.
Apple's strategy, not to get back on Apple, but I think it's interesting that Apple has decided that they're going to be the privacy company, the security company. Even despite the fact that, you know, these iCloud accounts got hacked and so forth. I think that's a smart move. And it is, in a way, seeing the writing on the wall that people are going to depend so much on these devices that you need to be able. For instance, Apple says, we're not going to be able to decrypt. We're not going to help you anymore, law enforcement, if you ask for a decryption on the iPhone. Currently, there's a queue. You can get it, and in a few months, Apple will give you decrypted data from a bad guy's iPhone. Apple says, we're not going to do that anymore. Although Matthew Green, the cryptographer, has pointed out that's not really any change in the way Apple works. They're just going to move more data than before into there. In the past, mail, text messages, photos were excluded from the normally encrypted data on your iPhone. Now everything, including attachments, managed books from the program iBooks, app launch images, location data will be encrypted with keys protected by the user's passcode. Calendar, excluding attachments, contacts, reminders, notes, messages, photos, and health ancillary data implement protected until first user authentication. So this is a good move on Apple's part. They see the writing on the wall. This is a way to make more money, sell more iPhones.
And Microsoft has been doing the same thing with mobile devices for a couple years now. Yeah. And encrypted by default. They don't have the keys.
Yep.
And that's the real issue, is who has the keys.
Yes.
If the keys, and the Washington Post did a spectacularly naive editorial yesterday where they talked about, there has to be a way for law enforcement to be able to get this data. So maybe the wizards at Apple and Google could come up with a magical way to create golden keys that they can save and reserve.
It's called a backdoor.
When they get the proper warrant. Well, it's called key escrow,
yeah.
Which has been, you know.
Do you trust him? Yeah, no, I think this, I understand law enforcement's upset. They don't want there to be anything that they can't look into if they need to. But I think I don't think there's any question Apple has the right to do this, and that consumers want this.
Absolutely. I mean, especially when we've seen how law enforcement oversteps their boundaries. I mean, I want you to have a warrant and do your job as police officers and detectives. And I recognize that maybe not having access to some of this stuff might make your job harder. And that's too bad. But what did you do before there were cell phones? What did you do before all this information was around?
Just to play devil's advocate. Shouldn't we then be making sure that law enforcement follows the proper procedures and does have warrants and it's court supervised, but still have key escrow? I mean, shouldn't we? Ed, why did you say that was a naive proposal? I mean, we do need some way of investigating terrorists and criminals, don't we?
Well, we had the Patriot Act, which was passed in 2001.
Well, let's fix that, though.
Well,
I understand fine. I understand it didn't work and there was no oversight. But what if we could make it work and have good oversight and have good court oversight? Wouldn't that be better than just shutting off the hose?
I think we just bring a unicorn to court for every warrant hearing, and then everything will work properly. The reality is we've already proven beyond a shadow of a doubt in this country that under the proper fear level, legislators will pass laws that make it possible for things to be done in secret that we don't know about.
Right.
So if you have a key that is held in escrow and you have a law that says we are the government and we can have a warrant and you can't talk about this warrant for national security reasons, for the purposes of fighting terrorists or for whatever, then that escrowed key is used to decrypt your data and nobody knows about it. And you can talk about all of the procedural safeguards for making sure that constitutional rights are respected in a situation like that. But the reality is that if you have the key and someone else can get to the key and they can hold a gun to your head and say, don't tell anyone that I got this key from you, then whoever is the actual, whoever thinks they are the actual owner of that data doesn't really own it. The only way that you own that data is if you are the sole owner of the decryption key and nobody else can access it except you.
I just worry that, there's some pretty horrible actors out there like the Islamic State. I wonder if these people will then all switch to iPhones and...
But that's the thing, though. It's a false premise, I think, because Apple's not offering up the decryption keys doesn't mean that people can't still access this data. It doesn't mean there aren't still people who can reverse engineer things. And people, in fact, do. I mean, in fact, there are a lot of people who Jonathan ZDZ, I can't
Zdarsky.
Pronounce his last
name,
Zdarsky, who's fantastic. And he wrote, an article on his blog, and he's pretty much, I would say, the foremost iOS kind of a security and forensic guy out there. There's still software and tools out there that these agencies can get. And I would think, especially at the high levels of people who are wanting to do things like investigating the Islamic State. What this doesn't make it as easy for is for, say, like the Polk County Police Department, who's trying to investigate, a drug user's, iPhone. Maybe their job is going to be a little bit more difficult. But let's be honest. I mean, maybe it should be. Maybe they have been. And to this point, we're not sure because, as Ed was pointing out, these things that are in place where people are able to gain access to, these warrants without having to have any sort of paper trail or any sort of transparency. We don't know how they've been getting access to stuff. But I firmly believe that just because Apple's not handing over the keys, it in no way means that there's no way to access this information. And that's, it becomes more difficult, granted. But I think that's kind of one of those trade-offs we have to have with being a free society and having, a system of laws, is that if we are going to say that we have rights and that we have a right to privacy, then that means that companies shouldn't feel as if they have to hand over the keys to these, all these systems to the government. Because, to me, that really bothers me fundamentally as an American, the idea that we would entrust the government automatically with this stuff and say that just because you're law enforcement, you get access to this. Because there are probably easier ways than even going that far for people who are skilled to break into this stuff if you really need to get the information.
Right.
So I feel like it's a false economy. Orrin Kerr saying things like, this is all pedophiles, or whoever the man was who said the pedophiles all use the iPhone. Okay, first of all, that's really incendiary language, and it really bothers me kind of using that sort of rhetoric. Second of all, it's not as if you're going to say that no one can ever break into this. That's not what it's saying. It's simply saying that Apple, from a matter of liability, and let's be clear, Apple's not doing this because they love their users. They're doing it because they don't want to be liable for having to be responsible to unlock this stuff.
It's also a very good positioning for Apple to say we're the privacy company. Although there will be some backlash from people who quite reasonably say, yeah, but now who's going to protect us against terrorists? So, believe me, I'm playing devil's advocate here.
Oh, I know, and I agree.
But I don't think it's unreasonable for people to raise that issue. Like, you know, I remember talking to Phil Zimmerman about PGP, and of course, the first thing you say is, "Well, great, you're now providing completely secure email for everybody, easy to use." Not wasn't as it turned out that easy to use. easy to use. Aren't you empowering terrorists? And Phil was very clear. He said, "Yeah, but we live in a free society, and it's important that people be able to protect their privacy." And it's like the First Amendment. You just have to you have to do it.
Well, it's no different from a law enforcement agency saying criminals live in houses.
Right.
Houses have front doors with locks on them. We need to ban locks because the police need to get into criminals' houses.
Right.
And you know whenever it's necessary. Fine. You need procedures to break through locks. There will, I guarantee it, be ways for law enforcement and especially national security to target the information of the really, truly bad guys. They're just going to have to deal with a landscape that has shifted in favor of privacy. And we need to take that. I like what Apple has done in terms of talking about law enforcement, but I want to see that shift to the commercial sector as well.
Right.
I want to see far fewer web properties and advertising agencies and data marketers indiscriminately gathering wholesale amounts of data on people from around the world just because they can. I would love to see, not just for law enforcement, but for everything, to see the expectation of privacy shift to something that is in favor of the individual.
Hear, hear. I agree. Now, on that note, let's take a small break and continue in just a bit with more with Ed Bott of ZDNet, Christina Warren of Mashable. If you missed anything, which I did, actually, I missed the entire week. So fortunately, we prepared this brief video to let you know what you missed and I missed this week on Twit.
Let's go to the top story. It's all about Windows 10. Not Windows 9, not Windows the Rod.
Where did Windows 9 go?
Why is it called Windows 10?
Because 7, 8, 9.
7, 8. 9.
And 7, 8, 9, right? So, you know.
Previously, I thought I was so clever. On Twit, Windows Weekly.
This is the last major version of Windows, they're saying.
They literally are putting this out at a much earlier point than they ever have. Mm. And this is the new way they do things.
Yep.
They want, is this what you want? No, let us know what you want.
Right.
Security Now.
iOS 8's Mac randomization is almost never active. Maybe they couldn't do it, but don't advertise it as always random until you're connected. That's a lie.
Marketing Mavericks.
Pictures of people using QR codes.tumblr.com.
Wait, where are all the posts?
Nobody uses QR code because it was too many things to do, and then you didn't give anybody anything good. Didn't give you a free pony, a rocket ship.
I want a unicorn.
This is your brain. This is your brain on Twit. Any questions?
Well, I'm out of here. That's it for me. Thanks, everybody.
That looked like a setup. I'm just saying. That's what you missed this week on Twit. Did Mike do a week ahead? Let's see what Mike Elgin's planning on covering this week on TNT.
Coming up this week, HTC is holding an event called Double Exposure on Wednesday, October 8th in New York City. Probably some kind of camera or smartphone camera announcement. Thursday, October 9th is going to be a huge news day. Sony is holding an event in New York also, possibly the U.S. launch of the new Xperia Z3 smartphone line. The first ever Internet.org summit takes place in New Delhi, India on Thursday. Internet.org, of course, brings affordable internet connectivity to parts of the world that currently don't have it. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg himself is the keynote speaker, and Zuck will probably meet with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi while he's in India. Also on Thursday, Tesla will officially announce something called the D, according to a cryptic tweet by CEO Elon Musk. He also teased a mystery announcement of some kind as well. Well, that's what's coming up this week. Back to you, Leo.
Mike Elgin, it's turning into the Announcement Factory, TNT, Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m., 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 1700 UTC on this very network. Watch every day and you will not miss a thing. Our show today brought to you by the great folks at Citrix, who do Citrix GoTo Meeting, the way to meet online, to collaborate online. With GoTo Meeting, you not only can be on the same page because you're screen sharing, you'll even see each other face to face with crystal clear high def video. That's why millions of business professionals rely on Citrix GoTo Meeting to connect with remote clients, with coworkers, to pitch It is just a great, even with offices that are spread out, you just keep GoToMeeting running. It's like you're working together. It's amazing. Right now, if you sign up for GoToMeeting before October 10th, you'll get another Citrix product of your choice free for 6 months. This is a good deal. This is a good deal. So share screens, HD video conferencing, work smarter, team anywhere in the world. You're all together. You could do it on a computer, a tablet, or smartphone. And right now, when you sign up for that free 30-day trial of GoToMeeting, you're going to get 6 months free of the Citrix product of your choice. That's a good deal. Visit GoToMeeting.com and get started. But remember, October 10th, the end of the line on this. GoToMeeting.com, try it free. And if you would, use the offer code TWIT. They don't ask us to say that, but I'm going to say it. Tell them you heard it on TWIT. Let's see, real quickly, UK legalizes CD ripping.
What's
right,
a CD?
Right on! The UK copyright, by the way, still illegal, I think, in the US, but the UK copyright law was amended to legalize, actually, no, CD ripping has always been legal, but DVD ripping is not, because it has copy protection on it, right? In the UK, you can do anything you want. You can rip CDs. You can rip DVDs. You can copy MP3s as long as it's for personal use and without copyright protection. Oh. What?
Wait a minute.
Wait a minute.
That's kind of a big loophole that's stuck in there right at the
wait
very
a minute.
End. Damn it.
Dang it. Okay. I'm reading an article from Torrent Freak UK. These changes aim to fix the mismatch between law and public opinion. 85% of consumers in the UK thought that it was already legal to rip DVDs and CDs. One third of all consumers said, yeah, we make copies of the media we purchased. I think in the US, you're allowed to make copies for archival purposes, right? To back up. I don't know. And I think it's the same things in the US. No one knows what's legal.
The other 15% said, who?
Huh? What's a CD? What's a DVD then?
I was going to say that we should go around. Does anybody actually have a machine like nearby that has an optical drive connected to it? Because my iMac, I believe, still has an optical drive. I think that's the only thing I've got left in my house other than my standalone DVD players and Blu-ray players that actually has an optical drive built in. I don't even think I have any machines other than my iMac.
Physical media is dead.
Xbox still has a DVD player in it.
It does, but I don't use it. In fact, I realized that I should. Oh, wait a minute. What's this? This is a CD ripper. Ooh, from Samsung. Does this allow you to copy Apple designs as well? That is not legal.
So what would be really cool would be if you could just put a DVD on top of that thing and just copy it.
Still illegal in Australia and other British Commonwealth nations. I feel like streaming media is so dominant now. And I don't understand, you know, I mean, I guess Redbox just sat down their streaming service or their net, whatever it was. It's just, but we're going to get 4K, and Sony has announced a new Blu-ray player that's for, it's going to have to buy a new one for 4K video.
Yep.
And I guess 4K is so big, you're probably not going to stream that, right?
Right. So, I mean, with Netflix a little bit, but it's
not good quality.
The thing is, it's got to be 15 megabits sustained, which most people, if you're getting Netflix, you can't have that anyway. Right. I mean, so it's got to be a huge pipe. And then the quality is not as good as if you could get it standalone. So for 4K, I mean, it was funny at the beginning of the year, I was on some news program and I was making predictions when we were talking about 4K. And I kind of half joked, was half serious. I was like, well, actually, maybe disc will come back because of 4K. But I only say that because the file size is so big. But for everything else, I mean, I think until 4K TVs are really out there in abundance, I mean, I love physical media because I like the quality and I like the extra features. But if I'm being honest, 99% of what I watch is still from streaming and from other places.
It's convenience trumps quality, I think.
Sadly.
Yeah.
I found it fascinating.
Sadly. I miss my extra features.
You can get DVD commentary. You want me to do... Okay. And then I decided that I was going to...
Yes.
Change the script. No, I love DVD commentaries. Do they still do those?
They do. They do. And that's the only way you can get them is if you buy the Blu-ray and the DVD. And so a lot of times
I think we could fix that.
We could. It's just sadly, fewer and fewer people care about that stuff.
That's the reason. They don't do it because no one wants it.
I know, but I worry because I got into filmmaking and I got into film history through Laserdisc and through DVD and things like that. Yeah. And I worry about the generation coming up who's never going to discover that sort of stuff.
Francis Ford Coppola's commentary on Godfather 1 is a graduate course in filmmaking.
It is, without a doubt. Scorsese's commentary on Taxi Driver is one of the best. Roger Ebert does a commentary on Citizen Kane, which is fantastic.
Oh, I'd love to hear that.
He also does one with Spike Lee on Do the Right Thing. I mean, there are all these great commentary tracks where you learn so much about the film. And
I had Do the Right Thing on Laserdisc, but it didn't have any commentary on it.
Yeah, the DVD from 2001 did.
Now, iTunes now has DVD extras. They're crap.
They are. They're awful.
They're not. There's like the one thing I want is the commentary.
Exactly.
They're like the video equivalent of a free U2 album.
Yeah. Thank you, Apple.
Basically. Yes. They do like featurettes and maybe some deleted scenes.
Yeah, they're featurettes. Yeah.
And the featurettes, what's not good about those are the ones that like you make, the studio makes to promote the film that like they put on HBO in between, you know, movies. Yeah. And no one cares. So it's not even a real like documentary because there's some things like there's like this 2-hour Jaws documentary that was on the Laserdisc and then on the DVD and the Blu-ray, which is fantastic. If it was that quality, great, awesome. But it's not. So like I don't want to see the studio, you know.
I've heard studios say we don't do extras, we don't do commentary because nobody wants to do them. Like the directors don't want to go in there and do
this. They see it as a chore.
It's a chore. I think that's a chore they don't get paid for either, by the way.
Well, they usually don't. But there have been so many good ones. Jerry Maguire, Cameron Crowe, all of his commentaries are great. But there was a great the whole cast got together and you know Tom Cruise and the director for Jerry Maguire, and that one was really good. And actually, so
just make podcasts and put a thing that says start DVD now, and then we can do it.
I know. I've been kind of joking and not really joking about the fact that I kind of want to get an underground group of people together to collect all the DVD commentaries.
Why isn't Kevin Smith doing this? He loves doing commentaries.
He does. He does. And I think he does actually, as for some of his podcasts, he does some of those things. I know Battlestar Galactica, a lot of the episodes there, they did the commentaries as podcasts and then released them on the DVDs. But more directors need to do that. I don't know. I feel like we lose so much when we get rid of some of these extras. I'm not so concerned about like the films that are out now. I'm more concerned about like when stuff goes out of print.
Yeah.
And then you have, you know, like I don't want to lose Coppola's commentary on Godfather 1. No. You know what I mean? Like I don't want to lose that to time. I don't want to lose some of this stuff when these things go out of print and the rights are gone and then they're just lost in the ether and we've got, you know, this historical moment, which is so incredibly important and such a great educational resource. And then it's gone just because technology moved forward and we didn't bother to, you know, bring over the extras.
All anybody cares anymore about is selfies. And
well, and what they care about.
What do they care about? What? What? Tell me, what do they care about?
I'm gonna.
We'll never know.
Turn this microphone out as soon as we're done here.
We will never know.
This thing is trying to kill me. It's the ghost of Bob Marley. It's basically.
What do they care about, man?
I'm not gonna move. I'm gonna sit here perfectly motionless. No, what they care about is selling you data.
Right. Reason they did commentary was to sell DVDs.
Was to fill the space on DVDs. And so what I thought was fascinating this week, what I thought about as soon as you started talking about DVD extras was AT&T is now doing a big promotional special where if you sign up for a new account, they'll double. If you sign up for the 15 gigabytes per month plan, they'll double it to 30 gigabytes.
Yeah.
And I'm
That's
going,
twice as much data you'll never use.
Holy crap. Who would use 30 gigabytes of data per month? But if you are using that as your only source of data, and
no, we'll charge you for that.
And all of a sudden, I mean, they, you know, these guys aren't stupid. Are they anticipating a world 2 years from now where my measly 2 gigabytes of data a month that I use suddenly becomes 20 and I have no choice but to pay for their high priced plans? But the bottom line is that the movie producers have always been Philistines. And they, you know, they do not care about the quality of the art. They care about butts in the seats and tickets sold.
That's why we have podcasts for people who want to lose money. Why we created them.
Yeah. I'm going to look at that term sheet you sent me, Leo.
Want to lose money? Podcasting. Hey, so much fun to have you guys on. I'll tell you why I do these shows, because I get to talk to people, smart people like Ed and Christina, and spend some time with them. I just love doing it every week, and I thank you both for being here. Ed Bott, what do you want to plug? Give me something. I got to get something to you.
Just don't buy these damn headphones.
Never buy Marley headphones.
No. They're actually really nice headphones.
They're made of wood.
I've been writing some really good stuff on Windows 10.
Yes, you have. Yes.
ZDNet.com/blog/bot, or just Google my name in ZDNet and it'll all come up. But there's much more stuff in the pipeline.
Bot has two T's. And the Ed Bott Report, ZDNet.com/blog/bot, is absolutely a must-read if you want to keep up. And, you know, we didn't mention this, but I think it's interesting that Microsoft actually, you can sign up, anybody can sign up and get the Windows 10 right now, the technical preview.
Yep.
Should they do that? Is it how reliable is it? Does it short circuit your microphone and make your ears bleed?
No, this is Windows. This is Windows 7 doing this to me.
Okay, right now, so. All right. So people can actually. Microsoft has a site where you can go and you can get it.
Right. I would recommend this for anybody who, if you have successfully installed Windows on your own PC and you know how to do a backup, you have satisfied the two prerequisites.
And is it version complete enough to do work with, or is it just something to look at?
No. You can use it. It's
a Windows.
It's very, very solid. Wow. I would call it Windows 8.22. You know, something like that. It's very solid. Missing a few little things, but and if you sign up for it, the Insiders program, they call it, and you install it today, you will get the updates installed automatically. That's part of the deal.
So I should do this in my VM on OS 10, for instance, to be a good place to play with it a little
bit. One interesting thing about it is that this is finally a version of Windows post Windows 7 that works well in a VM. The Windows 8 interface with the corners you had to touch to make things happen.
It drove me crazy.
Oh, it was nuts in a VM, because getting your mouse. Yeah. Oh, damn it! I went into the parent operating system here. But with this, you click the start button, and there's the start menu, and everything's in a window, and everything has a menu, and so it's for somebody who's coming from Windows 7, it should be a very familiar experience. Ironically, for people who have adapted to Windows 8 and 8.1 and have learned the workflow and all the shortcuts, it's going to feel like two steps forward and one step back.
Christina, you, I see in the chat room, you installed this in a VM on OS 10. It works great, huh?
It does. It works great. I did it in Parallels, and it's working excellent. And I also put it on a Surface Pro too, so I was able to test it both on real hardware and then in a VM, and it's great on a VM.
Insider.windows.com. It's free, right? You just join
it's free,
it?
Yeah. And if you're doing it on a Mac, just here's what you need to do: set your user agent for Windows for Internet Explorer, and it'll let you download the ISO, and then you can install it on your VM. Otherwise, if it recognizes that you're not on a Windows machine, they won't let you download the ISO. But if you change your user agent, that's all you got to do.
Yeah, I'm in Internet Explorer. Yeah, that's it. Version 6,
Christina. Christina Warren is at Mashable.com. Anything you want to plug? You do podcasts galore. What do you do?
So I've got a podcast with my friend Brett Terpstra, TT Scoff on Twitter, called Overtired. And tune into that, Overtired, on a 5x5. It's just basically us random ADD nerds just talking about nerd stuff. So
it's just, there's no particular portfolio,
No, we have kind of a list of topics that we don't talk about each week, and we just kind of go on tangents about things that are keeping us awake at night, and that's basically it.
Overtired at 5x5.tv. Thank you, everybody, for being here. We do Twit every Sunday, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That would be Pacific time, 6 p.m. Eastern time, 2200 UTC. Please tune in and watch live if you can. Chat room is always welcome. We have lots of fun. We didn't mention HP spinning off its PC business. Who cares? I don't care.
Leo Apothecaire.
Do you care?
Yeah.
Leo Apothecaire. Right. He said, I wanted to do this. Now they're doing it. Whatever happened to Leo Apothecaire?
He's the George Costanza.
Yeah. He really is. He spent $10 billion on that company that they then had to write off for $8 billion.
Yeah, was that Overture? What was that? Yeah, nice.
It was sort of with an A. I can't think of the name.
Them.
Yeah. 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 The one that there was like all the financial misgivings. Yeah. Them.
Hey, by the way, I'm an insider. Thank you, Ed Bott. I am an insider now. Windows.
You're very
inside.
Welcome. Yes. Call my 900 number if you need support.
I might. Ed has a very good article on installing Windows 10 if you want to know more. If you can't watch live, we do have on-demand audio and video available after the fact. Yes, we're in the podcast business. All you have to do is go to iTunes, Stitcher. There are lots of apps. There's great apps for literally Twit apps on all the platforms, including Roku, Windows Phone, iOS, and Android. And there's lots of other ways to get it. I'm sure you'll find a way, but do subscribe so you get it every week. You don't want to miss an episode. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Another Twit.
This is in the game.
Yay.